The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Where did you live and what were you doing before you became a hippie?
I was a graduate student at Yale in urban planning. I got caught up in the politics of the time. It was 1970, and I headed west to hunt for utopia.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Margaret Grunstein, author of Naked in the Woods, My Unexpected Years in a Hippie Commune. What was happening in the country at that time? What did you get caught up in that motivated you and your friends to head west?
There was a desire in urban planning and architecture. There are disciplines that you look for utopian better worlds. The politics of Vietnam were there. The racial politics of integration were there. And the student activism was there. Everywhere around us, there were students taking over Columbia, Berkeley, the student, free speech movements. And as I say in the book, I'm nothing if not a competitive achiever. Within the city planning department, we took over some of the politics of the administration of the school and moved to bring in more students of color. And my husband at the time was active in the black community. He was Indonesian. He could morph into different communities. And with Kent State, it became clear that when students were killed, the stakes had increased, that just singing We Shall Overcome, just taking over schools, just trying to bring a better world about, it wasn't going to happen easily. And so the thought was, okay, if we can't change the outside world through our activism, then let's create a world ourselves that will be a little better than the world that we're stepping away from.
And you landed in Oregon, well, you and your husband, whom you had just married, and about 10 other friends. Where did you live and what happened?
Well, we came in bits and pieces. I drove out west with my husband and a friend of his. We got there. We didn't quite know what to do. We rented an apartment. Other people came out. We didn't have a plan, and I think that's pretty evident throughout the whole book. And so we rented a place in Eugene, and I needed something to do because I'm a very project-oriented person. And I started baking in the Giant Zucchini, which was a restaurant within the YMCA in Eugene. And as people came through and there were some discussion, one day my husband came back and he said, "We rented a farm." And I said, "What farm?" I didn't know we were going to rent a farm. But in the beginning, it was just sort of collecting in bits and pieces and trying to figure out where we were going to go next.
It was February when you moved in, so the warm season was coming. And you spent the summer just kind of being there. But how did you feed yourselves? What did you do for money?
Well, we still had unemployment checks. We had tax returns coming in. As different people filtered in, they had some money from, they'd bring money with them, or we had the little savings that we came with. And there was some government surplus, so there's endless peanut butter and blocks of government surplus cheese and probably some rice and some beans there too, I can't remember. And the land was so lush. I mean, you just walked out, there were crayfish in the creek, there were blackberries on the vines if they hadn't been sprayed by the road crews to kill, cut them back. You go to U-Pick orchards. There were orchards in the fields there. People would stop by and give you a piece of bear meat. Salmon, people were always catching salmon, and people traded. So it's a plush and lush valley there. And we still had money left over from having just stepped out of the other culture.
And it went well for about a year on that land.
Yes.
And not so well later, which we'll get to in a while. But I really love the scene in which a woman neighbor drove a tractor over to help you plow your first garden. And I wonder if you would mind reading that.
Okay. "Before we could plant, we needed to till the soil, first plowing and then harrowing to break the dirt into ever smaller particles. I turned to the men for help. We had an old tractor left in the barn by the landlord, which looked more like a relic for a farm museum than a useful piece of machinery. Clint, a mechanical alchemist who could turn dross into gold, was excited. One person's trash was another person's treasure. He got it to run, although using it was often a stop, tweak, and go situation. Today, the goal was to smooth the roughly plowed garden by dragging a heavy log attached to the back of the tractor over the soil, our jerry-rigged alternative to a harrow. We needed to break down the clods. Rogie and Don volunteered for the job, happy to help, high on something other than a strong work ethic. They started the morning at 10, each ingesting a tab of acid. Getting the tractor fired up and out of the barn was the first challenge. Don fiddled with a carburetor and adjusted screws while Rogie worked the clutch and starter. Success! Then they needed to position the makeshift harrow. Rogie and Don struggled to carry the log from the barn to the field. There they wrapped chains around each end and secured them tightly, making sure each was of equal length. Finally, they positioned the log and attached the chains, making sure it was properly lined up behind the tractor. If the pull was uneven, the tractor dragged the log at an angle and it was useless. This setup could take at least half an hour, sometimes longer, the variables being the truculence of the log and the whim of the engine. On this day, Don stepped up to the tractor and settled his bottom onto the open palm of the metal seat. He started the motor, pleased with the regular firing of the engine. It promised a strong and steady pull. Behind him, Rogie squatted low, facing the recalcitrant log, riding shotgun against the dangers inherent in the setup. Everything was in place. They formed a frieze, silhouetted against the sun, awaiting Don's pull at the lever that would set it all in motion. Then the acid hit. Don's last coherent act was to disengage the clutch and shut off the temperamental engine. Rogie looked around. His eye caught every mutating detail. Nothing needed to be said. Together they stepped down, away from the tractor and into another reality, their work done for the day. Clearly we needed additional help. A young couple, Richard and Helen, along with their new baby Alice, shared our valley. We often saw them plowing their fields, straddling the seat of their new tractor, working hard on their homestead. I asked Mary Ellen and Janet to come with me. Maybe we women couldn't plow, but we certainly knew how to ask for assistance. Our neighbors greeted us cordially. Richard listened carefully, smiled warmly, and said, "Sure, we'd love to plow. We'll come over as soon as we finish up here." Thrilled with our ingenuity, Janet, Mary Ellen, and I walked home and awaited their arrival. Soon their tractor lumbered up our road, slowly coming into focus as it moved closer to our farm. "Here they come. I can see them. Is that Richard driving?" "I don't know. It doesn't look like him." "Oh, my God. I think it's Helen. Helen's driving." "You mean that's her on the tractor?" "Yes, yes, it's Helen. Is she going to plow?" We clustered at the edge of our field, a flock of sparrows all a-twitter over what was happening. A woman was driving, a nursing mother with a tiny baby at home whose husband was willing to care for their newborn while she drove off in the tractor. Our men wouldn't stay at home to change diapers while we plowed. Then again, we didn't know how to plow. Just a year ago, I had been working in New Haven, debating if I could get away with wearing pants rather than a skirt to work. And now, putting up our road to our field was a woman who was definitely wearing pants to work. We watched transfixed. I ran to get my camera and photograph her, our new hero, a woman with milk in her tits and a shaft in her hand, negotiating gears from her perch high on the open tractor, heading forward but looking back over her shoulder, making sure that the tiller she pulled behind her was raised high enough to avoid the rocks and bumps in the unpaved road between our farms. We waved as Helen passed, running to catch up with her at our field. Old ways plowed under. As she turned our soil, her husband home rocking their baby to sleep. I planted a lesser version than my original plan, but that garden, my first, was as beautiful to me as any child is to its mother. Watching the seeds sprout, monitoring their growth, and daily nursing each little bud into fruition was a labor of love. Helen had her baby, the pageant players had theirs, and I had mine. Beets sprouted and pushed up from the dark soil, first showing their tufted greens and then their dusky shoulders. Beans ran rampant above ground, their little white flowers giving birth to thin green threads that turned, overnight, into full-fledged haricot verts, ready for dinner if they made it that far. None of us had gardened before, let alone tasted produce direct from the ground. We were city kids. Vegetables were still afterthoughts, extras that graced the meat and potatoes of a meal. Salad meant hard, round heads of iceberg lettuce. The food revolution arrived on our backs as we discovered the glories of the harvest. Now there was a whole new lexicon of leaf lettuces to explore. I planted butter, bib, oak leaf, and black-seeded Simpson. If we only harvested the outer leaves and not the entire head, they would continue to form delicate new growth from their centers, virtual energizer bunnies of the salad world that kept us in greens for weeks. Pagan religions and fertility goddesses were starting to make sense. Eating a carrot pulled fresh and warm from the ground was a ritual as meaningful as a first communion or a bar mitzvah. We crossed the threshold, changed, and committed ourselves to a new truth. Back to nature was one of the things that worked as advertised. But where were the men? What did those guys do all day? The answer was dope. Whatever, wherever, and however they could. That was what they planted in their garden. Clint, Don, Guy, and Hakeem labored under the hot summer sun, wending their way through scratchy undergrowth to hidden plots tucked away in natural clearings. Every drop of water, roll of fencing, and load of fertilizer had to be hand-carried on unmarked paths, a daily chore that required the passion of the converted and the tenacity of an addict. Like womenfolk trading child-rearing techniques, the men were a community unto themselves, full of tales and helpful hints regarding their crops. I watched from the kitchen as they sat outside, passing a joint and slapping their knees, sharing the progress of their homegrown weed. They could have been farmers from a century ago, sitting on a Cracker Barrel in the local general store. These were the keepers of the counterculture, the nurturers of its mainstay. I took care of the vegetables. They took care of the drugs. It was a bumper year.
What happened to their activism ambitions once you got to that piece of land?
My husband was a very strong personality and a strong leader, and he was the more visionary, I think, in terms of politics. And also every day was, if you hand ground the wheat to make the whole wheat flour, that was activism. They saw, or many people saw, free love as activism. Opening our doors to everybody who came through was activism. But I do remember one event where I'd come back from town and with my husband, and we had cashed a tax return. And we were sitting down for lunch at the communal table, and we're all sitting there, and at the end of the meal, he stands up and he takes out all our cash and he slaps it on the table. He says, "This is all we've got. You know, I'm putting it in the communal pot. Who else is going to do it?" So that he was still, there was, okay, what are we going to do about money? And he was dramatic, so that's how he did it. Of course, I'm sitting there thinking, hey, what about me? We're married. That's our money. And then other people responded to this, but so activism was there in the garden. Dope was a political act at that time. So many small things. Raising the chickens, making our own bowls with a lathe out of wood. All of these things, because there was a social activism, a political activism, an economic activism, and they carried out within the community as opposed to a colonial power imposing it on another community.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Margaret Grunstein about her memoir, Naked in the Woods, My Unexpected Years in a Hippie Commune. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. The audio is posted on our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the failure of feminism in the commune. Don't go away. Feminism was a very big deal in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
And it seemed like, from what you write in this book, this 5 years experience that you had, that you were kind of caught between the old ways and new ways of thinking. When you got to this land and you were trying to be a new kind of woman, it didn't work out very well. I mean, the tractor is one example.
You know, we were, as I said, city people, and we were in the country. And there's a different ethic, and we were privileged in the sense that we were all well-educated and at an elite institution. Our skills and our equality came often, we didn't have children, so it came through intellectual means as we were students. And our voice, where was our voice heard? And these questions don't go away now. They're still here, I think. But on the farm, you know, it became a little bit, okay, who can do the machinery? We weren't trained with machinery. All of a sudden, we've stepped back in terms of the rights that we think we've gained for ourselves through feminism. You know, you could burn your bra, but still, that doesn't mean I can fix a tractor. But the men also, I remember one couple that did, Guy and Janet did most of the baking. You know, the guys helping more with the cooking at that point. As we moved to the undeveloped land, the 160 acres, that's where things really fell apart a bit, I think, in terms of feminism, because we needed brawn. We needed more masculine skills. And so things broke down along very more like 19th century gender lines. Women cooked and cleaned and maybe lit the fire in the stove while the men chopped down the trees. And it didn't mean that women couldn't. And if you had a baby, you really were. It's much harder to find your place.
And we should explain that the second piece of land had no ranch house with electricity and running water and a telephone. It was very rustic, and you had to build your own places to live. So a woman with a baby who's trying to take care of that baby and just take care of herself really can't build a house and plow and do all of those things. So it did become a lot harder for the women.
I mean, the joke always was every recipe we made started with, first you cut down a tree, because you couldn't cook till you cut down the tree, chop down the wood, you know, started the fire, ground the berries or whatever it was, you know, heated the water to wash everything. So, and if you did have a baby there, how to protect that baby. It was harder. And then also you brought that baby home to a place where you didn't have running water. And it was forest. It wasn't a meadow. It was forest with no utilities whatsoever.
Right. No running water.
No electricity. Yeah. None of the, no phones.
Oh, well, you couldn't even get to your houses, really, because you had to park down below and walk up a hill, a half a mile or so?
Yeah.
So carrying a baby and food and whatever, supplies up the hill.
And our vehicles were always somewhat patched together. You know, it was self-imposed poverty, but I certainly understood some of the restrictions of poverty. Before, you know, frequently you had to push start the car or park it on a hill to make sure it was going to start. So even, you know, the ease of transportation was not to be depended on.
Right. You wrote that living without a leader created a state of perpetual inaction. But everyone has to make decisions. So what was the dynamic in the group?
Let's say that with the money situation, we never decided on anything, and this now is the rule, and this is how we're all going to do it. So these ad hoc decisions would come up. But there were some situations when we moved to the land, the 160 acres, we moved our chickens with us. And we originally fenced them in, but then it was hard because we didn't have money for food and who's going to feed them, take care of them. And there were big debates, which sound absolutely ridiculous now, but they became, do chickens have free will? Should chickens have free will? Should they be free-range chickens or should we keep them fenced? We had broken all the fences around ourselves. So, and of course, you know, we had predators all around. So if something happened because one person took initiative, so I wasn't going to fence the chickens myself. Somebody else fenced them. But I took initiative on a garden there, but I couldn't do it myself. You know, I had to have someone else take some initiative on plowing it, or I had to ask them to do it. And then sometimes, you know, once the land was privately owned by Clint and Carol, there became complexities because they had money invested and what could or couldn't happen there. So land ownership and just the sense of this is mine and how do I husbanding or, you know, taking care of this for my future, this investment became more complex. So action happened, but sometimes things just didn't happen because you needed more people rallied together and it was sometimes hard. Or you would just find your little group and get that to get going.
And then when somebody finally did make a decision, Clint and Carol, everything kind of started to fall apart.
Well, as I was writing it, it became clear to me, it rose to the surface, that the ownership of the land became the fulcrum on which the story moved forward and that the demise really rested. That I truly, and maybe in some innocence, was there because I gradually came to feel that this is how I want to live. And I truly believe that this community is my community and this is where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. You know, some other people may have been there for political reasons because it was difficult in their country. Some other people may have been there because it was fun or they may have believed in it. But, you know, there are a variety of different motivations and levels of it. But we all made a good commitment to it. So when, over time, decisions had to be made that affected whether the land, what you could build on it. One couple wanted to build a Buckminster Fuller dome, but made out of concrete. And Clint didn't want that. He thought, you know, I'm going to be stuck with it. I don't want concrete. I want something, if it's going to, you know, it's wood, if it's going to decay, it's going to, you know, that'll fit in with the land. And I think that couple was very disillusioned. It was sort of like, well, look, I'm feel like this is mine, and you're telling me it isn't, and I can and can't do it, I'm finally realizing, uh-oh, this is your land, which I'm on here. In retrospect, that's a realistic point of view, that the land was an investment of money, and we had other options. But at the time, I think the trust was, we're here, we're all a group, we've made this commitment, how can you say no to me?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the title of the book for a minute, Naked in the Woods, because there are a few scenes where somebody feels like, oh, we're out here in the woods and we can take our clothes off and you built a sweat lodge, but it wasn't a nudist colony. So I looked at the title as maybe a metaphor. Did you see it that way?
You know, to be honest, and the Oregon State University Press has been exquisitely wonderful and supportive. I originally didn't care for the title because I was worried it was a little sensationalist. And as we worked and struggled for other titles, we all agreed that this was the best one and that because it does have the metaphor, because, you know, we were a pretty tame group if you actually think about it in some ways. Maybe I'm just looking at it in retrospect. But we were. I mean, I feel like I was naked in the woods and that my heart was vulnerable and open. As it is in love with you, you know, with a partner or your family or a new baby, there was a rebirth to an innocence of wanting to live a way that I felt was more meaningful, more open, more inclusive, and better. And I think we were each, our souls were naked in the woods, and we were to each other. When you live together day in and day out with you, you know, there's nothing hidden. You are naked to each other inside and out.
So what event or events finally made you leave that land?
Money. Unemployment had run out. tax returns had run out. I had picked brush, you know, taken it down to a shed to be sent to florists in Los Angeles, not making very much. I had tried odd jobs. I had no money. I had run out of money. And we needed some cash to survive on. And I woke up one night and accidentally stepped on my glasses. And I can see without my glasses, but I knew I needed them for reading and I couldn't replace them. And the time had come to face the fact that I needed to earn some money in a way that was meaningful. So I left in thinking that I would earn some money, send it back to the group, have some money, some savings when I came back. But in that time, the fight over the land came to a head and the decision was made that we were not going to own it collectively, even if we bought into it, that the couple who had it wanted to own it privately. And so I think I was hurt and didn't feel there was room, you know, why go back if there wasn't a place for me to build a future there.
What did you learn while you were in the woods that translated into your life after you left?
Gosh, there's so many things. I learned actual skills. I also learned that you could try something and generate things, and you could break rules, and sometimes you had to pay for that, but sometimes you had wonderful returns for that. In the sense, when I came back to the world afterwards and was working, and you know, I had to work very hard to make up for the financially in terms of a career and to support myself. So I paid a cost for that. It didn't just easily slip back in. I had five wonderful years. I had an adventure, and I followed it through to the end, not half-heartedly, not on the weekends, not on Friday nights. And when later I had two children and I was a single parent and I had to work hard, and at my age now, I don't look back and say, oh gosh, if only I had done this, or only. I have had the most fulfilling life on so many levels, and those 5 years were part of it. Whether it was the activism at school, of which I'm very proud, whether it was taking the risk, and I learned more about gardening. I learned more about living with people. I learned about how hard it is. I learned that utopia doesn't exist. We better find it in our hearts and in our present, and there's many ways to find it.
Well said. I would like to end with having you read a very short passage, just one paragraph on page 90.
At no time did I ever consider going back to my old life, the one forged from respectability. The thought of being bound by rigid hours within a closed building dimmed my light and made me heavy. I had no regrets. In Greenleaf, there were jobs to be done, responsibilities to the community, but I wanted to do them. Daily living was fun. Maybe it looked like we were doing nothing, but my life finally felt of value to myself and to the larger world. I had been a student most of my life. For years, under buzzing fluorescent fixtures, I had parsed good literature, explored the sages, and sought answers through assigned readings. Now I lived inside the text. I was the story.
Margaret Grunstein lives in Venice, California. Look for more information about her at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, book reviews and excerpts and weekly poems, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.